Well, that's good.
Good afternoon. We're in session. It's 1:20 in the afternoon. In attendance are Representative Lynn, Representative Gruenberg, Representative Herron, Representative Ramirez, Representative Holmes, Representative Gatto. I was in the back office with Representative Dahlstrom, who will be strolling in shortly. We have two pieces of business today, House Bill 324 and House Bill 366. We're going to take up House Bill 366 at about 2:30. So we're going to do about an hour and 10 minutes on the bail reform piece of legislation. I want to recognize my colleague, Representative Lynn. Representative Lynn, I had a nice conversation with Mike Sika and apologized for I wasn't feeling well. I probably should have canceled our hearing on Wednesday.
Are you feeling better now?
My poor health. I feel better, and I'm a big fan of Mike Sika and his work, and I am also a fan of yours. And so I apologize for being short with him. And any disrespect that I showed you, I want to apologize to you for that on the record. I'm very much enjoy serving with you, so I hope you will accept my apology.
Thank you very much. The important thing is just do the business we need to do. So let's get at it.
Roger that, sir. All right. So with that, we want to have Sue McClain come introduce herself and take us through the bail reform bill.
Good afternoon, Mr. Speaker. My name is Sue McClain. I'm the Division Director for the Criminal Division of the Alaska Department of Law. And I'm here today to talk to you about HB 324, which is a bail reform bill. And I'll start by saying I know there are discrete provisions in this bill over which there's some debate. And I want to start by talking about what the general purpose of this bill was when we started it. The bail statutes in the state have not been revised since 1966, 44 years ago. Since the original bail statute was enacted, we've added on and added on and added on, such that now if a person is sitting in court trying to figure out which statute applies to release someone on bail, there's layer after layer that of different bail statutes that apply to different kinds of offenses. So our first goal was to streamline those bail statutes into something that was more user-friendly, for lack of a better word, something that was easier to work with and to put together rather than have separate conditions of release for stalking, which are so similar to the conditions of release for domestic violence, to streamline those and get them into a much more usable format. That was our original intent, and that's where we started. The other thing that hasn't happened is the stream. Part of what's happened is that the a constitutional amendment was passed giving rights to crime victims. And as a result of that amendment, we've added many parts to the bail statute which don't fall neatly into place. So the primary purpose of this legislation is to streamline the bail statutes, make them easier to use, and give effect to the constitutional rights of crime victims within the statutes. The major features of this bill are as follows. First of all, the things that would change are that a person who's charged with a serious sex offense would be required to prove that release conditions before trial will protect the victim and the public. The bill will adopt standards for persons who may be appointed as third-party custodians for persons released on bail. The bill would prohibit a person found guilty of a serious sex offense from being released before sentencing or during appeal of the conviction. The bill protects victims of domestic violence by setting standards that the court must before allowing a perpetrator of domestic violence to return to the victim's residence. And the bill would allow more time before a defendant's first appearance in court for the police to investigate for the prosecutor to make an informed charging decision, to present better bail arguments on both sides, and to contact the victim so that the victim may be present when at the first bail hearing. It would be my intention now, Mr. Chairman, to go through a sectional analysis of the bill with the committee's indulgence.
Yes, please.
Okay. Section 1 of the bill, first of all, moves the crime of failure to appear, which currently exists in Title 12 and, as far as I know, has since 1966, to Title 11. It is a crime. It does have criminal penalties, and it moves it from Title 12 to Title 11. It is similar to current law with one exception. This failure to appear statute that we propose to put in Title 11 addresses what we call the Moffitt issue, and that is as follows. The crime of failure to appear, we have always understood the elements of the crime of failure to appear to be that a person knowing, and that is the state's burden to prove the person knew they had to appear in court, failed to appear in court. The Alaska Supreme Court of Appeals in 2009 decided a case called Moffitt versus State, in which they said there's a second burden of proof for the state. They found that implicit in the legislative intent was the state also has to prove that the defendant wasn't prevented by circumstances beyond his control from appearing.
Can I interrupt you? Representative Heron has a question.
I appreciate the sectional analysis, but this is, of course, the governor's Department of Laws bill. Could you go through, when you're going through the sections, could you say that by section whether you have concurrence with the court system, please?
May I amend that, please? Court system and whether you vetted this with the defense bar.
Section by section?
Your question is whether the rewrite of this has been vetted section by section is your question. Are you referring just to Section 1, or are you referring to the whole bill?
Setting aside my colleague's add-on is if you're in a section, I'd like to know, in your opinion, if the court system supports that rewrite.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative Grunberg.
Ditto for the defense bar. I just want to flag the ones that seem to be okay, and if you're not sure, you can say that. But the ones that seem to be okay, I'll probably take your word unless they say it's not, okay. And then we can focus on what we need to.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I now understand, Mr. Chairman, through the chair. With regard to Section 1, my understanding is I can't say the defense bar generally because I think that there are things that the public defender agrees with that there may be private attorneys that don't agree with. I know that the ACLU wrote a letter when the bill was presented in the other body, and I can't say that the public defenders or an individual defense attorney would agree with everything that was said in that letter. But I can say that there are some members of the defense bar who have issue with an attempt or this perceive this as an attempt to create new law, whereas the administration sees Section 1 as an attempt for the legislature to clarify what it meant by the law when it first passed it. What was the legislative intent of failure to appear? Section 2 is just sir.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So just to clarify, the Department of Law believes that Section 1 is clarifying legislative intent, but it would actually be counter to how it is currently being interpreted by the courts?
By the courts.
So this would be a change in how from how it's being interpreted, but you think it's what our time. Okay. Thank you,
right.
Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to be sure I was understanding.
Right. And if I, through the chair, Representative Holmes, the interpretation by the courts is a new interpretation. We've had convictions for failure to appear for 45 years.
Okay.
So this is news.
Okay. Thank you.
And we're
Mr. Chair.
Yep. Representative Grunberg.
A couple of days ago, we had the citation bill. And my recollection is that dealt with failure to appear also to answer a citation. And there were things that were changed in that to make it a crime to fail to appear for a citation. Does that at all interplay with this? It sounds like it's maybe the same kind of a thing.
Through the chair, I can only reiterate, I recognize there is some discussion about having some sort of criminality attached to failure to appear for a citation.
Yeah.
All I can say is there's always been criminality attached to failure to appear in court. I don't know of any state that doesn't have some kind of law that deals with, some of the states might call it bail jumping, but some kind of criminal sanction for failure to show up in court. And if I may go one step further, and I will be brief, please remember that in a felony case in the state of Alaska, there is no court if the defendant's not there. You can't go forward without the defendant. So failure to appear brings everything to a screaming halt, and there simply cannot be a hearing without the defendant in a felony case.
This is interesting. In any states, or are you aware of any constitutional impediment that if the person has notice and fails to appear, why can't you go forward constitutionally? Could we have a statute that did that? You know, a Roman Polanski situation or something.
The chair, respectfully, I believe that the right to be present at every stage of a criminal proceeding is a fundamental right.
May I just follow up, please? I'm talking about somebody who voluntarily, knowingly absents himself. Does that stop? So, or suppose they walk out in the middle of a trial?
Through the chair, different situation. We do have a statute that deals with that and a rule that deals with that. If a person has come to the beginning of a proceeding and voluntarily absents themselves from the proceeding may go forward because they're voluntarily absent.
If I may, with one follow-up, please. Okay?
Yes.
Suppose you have the person who's there at their arraignment or the date you set the trial,
yes,
and they're absolutely there in person with counsel, and then they don't show. Can you, or... Number one, it sounds like, Ms. McLean, through the chair, like now you couldn't go forward. Would there be any constitutional reason why we couldn't have a statute that had let you go forward?
Through the chair, we do have a statute that lets you go forward in that discrete situation that you've just described, which is the trial has begun.
No, I'm sorry. The calendar call, the person was there, absolutely had notice. We're going to go to trial on Monday at 10.
Right.
Be here, Mr. D.
Right.
And Mr. D doesn't show.
Mm-hmm. Through the chair.
Yes, ma'am.
I don't like to shoot from the hip on constitutional questions, but I think that that the Constitution would require that at the point a trial begins, the defendant has to be present.
If we could get a
Grunberg.
Since I'm sure we won't finish with this whole thing today, if we can get a definite answer, unless you're definite now. And the question would be, could we enact such a statute? Because I could see in some of these cases where the defendants will do anything they can to disrupt and delay the thing, they do it.
But
Ms. McLean.
Thank you, Mr. Through the chair. Representative Grunberg, we have several cases in the state of Alaska where the defendant wasn't present for a jury question, and the case has been overturned on appeal. Come so on. I would say that such a statute would be constitutionally on the edge at the very least. Mm-hmm. We do have that one statute about a defendant voluntarily absenting himself. Actually, I think it's a rule after trial has begun. But the other side of that is the defendant has to be present at every stage of a proceeding.
All right, so if you'll continue to take us through this, and if you will flag when this has been vetted by the defense bar and the court system, and when it hasn't, as we go through this, and we anticipate taking this bill up today for an hour, coming back and doing it a second time, and then trying to pass it out a third time. So we want to have three bites at this apple is what we're on target to do today. So I think the goal of the chair today would be to try to do an overview of the 17-page bill in the next hour, and then frame our questions into the second meeting that we have. And take any public testimony, and then in the third session to move toward amendments. It's kind of the format that Jane and I have worked out.
So we'll hold our questions?
Not necessarily, but you might not have to ask every single one of them.
Okay, that's fair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Should I proceed?
Yes, ma'am.
Section
Only ask a good question.
Section 2 is non-controversial. It's simply, it's a conforming amendment. Makes it clear, it conforms the language in certain cases from reasonable cause to probable cause, so that all of the language in throughout AS 1225030 reads probable cause. Probable cause and reasonable cause being the same standard. Section 2 also allows a law, I don't know of any controversy here, allows a law enforcement officer to arrest a person for violation of conditions of release if the officer has probable cause to believe the violation of conditions of release, the person has violated conditions of release. And it simply kind of codifies what we thought was the law, which is that an officer can arrest for a misdemeanor or felony committed in his presence. A person's in violation of conditions of release has probable cause to believe that he could arrest without a warrant. Section 3 adopts a new section that describes release procedures for people charged with crimes. Those procedures are similar to those under various sections of the existing law, and again, we're trying to synthesize, but there are a few differences, and they include before the third and subsequent bail hearings, the current law and the bill require that certain prerequisites are met. Current law requires some of this. 7 days have to elapse between bail hearings. Current law requires 48 hours notice to the prosecuting attorney. The bill requires the same notice, but it also requires 48 hours notice to any surety, anyone who's supposed to bail on behalf of the defendant. The bill specifically requires that the person who is released sign a release agreement that describes the conditions of release and includes the person's promise to abide by the conditions of release. Mm-hmm. The bill eliminates the current law that allows a judicial officer to change, eliminate, or change conditions of release at any time, because the law already provides a process for the judicial officer to do that, which is a bail hearing. And allowing a judicial officer to change the conditions without following the required procedures has the potential of being unfair to the defendant, the prosecuting authority, and the victim. Section 4 revises the law addressing release before trial of a person charged with a crime. Again, we have the synthesizing, but it adopts standards and condition of release for specific crimes, but it melds them all into one section, or one statute. 1230011 section B provides the conditions that a court may impose on a person charged with a crime if, in the court's discretion, the condition will reasonably assure the person's appearance and the safety of other victims. Many, if not most, of these conditions are the current law. Others are included in the federal bail law. Subsection C describes the various circumstances that the court should consider in deciding what conditions are reasonable to impose on a person. These are similar to current law. I want to flag this. There has been some suggestion that the bail bill creates warrantless searches where there weren't any before. In fact, it is the same in most respects as the current law is and has been for decades, in that a judicial officer may require a person, judicial officer who has a reasonable suspicion, may require a person to submit to a breath test if they're if they're released on a charge involving alcohol, may require them to submit to a search for drugs. A judicial officer may make these things as conditions of bail. And for the most part, they're very similar to current law. I have heard of a couple of defense attorneys, the ACLU for one, suggesting that all of these conditions are new and create new warrantless search provisions, and they don't. They, for the most part, mirror current conditions of release that a court may already impose. The one difference that comes to mind immediately is that it does change the conditions of release that a court, if a person is on medication, currently on medication, when they come before the court, that the court as a condition of release could require that they continue to take their medication. And that's aimed at people who are mentally ill, who don't get in trouble unless they don't take their medicine.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gatto.
Thank you. Would those be restricted to people using psychotropic drugs? Or what about antibiotics? What about,
you know, I'd have to read the language.
I mean, we can get into an awful lot. Yeah. I'm assuming it's only for psychotropic drugs.
It's intended that way.
Right.
And I, you know, I'd have to flip to the language of the bill itself too. I'll be able to answer that question completely next time I'm here. I just have to check the language of the statute.
Mr. Greenberg.
I think you're looking at page 6.
Thank you.
Line 16, section 16, lines 24 to 25. My only comment is, as a person who's a diabetic with heart condition, I think that's a very good provision, and I'm glad that's there. I assume that is constitutional.
I think so. If it's
good.
through the chair, I think that the constitutional law and conditions of release, or at least the Alaska constitutional law and conditions of release and condition of probation, is that they have to be reasonably related to the crime that the person is charged with committing, or to keeping the community safe from that person. That there has to be some reasonable relationship there, and there usually is.
Mr. Chair, the reason I'm saying that is if I don't take my insulin, I won't harm anybody but myself. And I would hope, and sort of ask you, Ms. McLean, I'll task you with doing this if that's a, if I may do that. If this is simply requiring the person to keep themselves safe by taking their meds, I think that's important. And people would say, well, people have a freedom not to take their insulin, but if they're under court jurisdiction, I would like to have something like this in there, and I'd like some good, strong authority that we can cite in the record and the debate that will support that, because I really strongly support what you're doing there.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gatto.
On that point, if you double dose on insulin, you can be a person who could harm another person. So I want to make sure that that is, we're going to write something specific on insulin, that that be clear.
I'll have to remember that in the closing days of the legislature.
It could be your closing day.
We change the seating chart immediately.
Through the chair, the question was, does it apply only to psychotropic medication? And the answer was no. If I may quote it, it ordered the person to take medication that was prescribed for the person by a licensed healthcare provider with prescriptive authority. So it would cover the situation that Representative Greenberg has discussed.
Good. Okay. Thank you for putting that on the record.
Right.
Thank you.
Right, you're going. We ate them all.
Subsection D, big flag here, there is a great deal of debate about this section. It provides the evidentiary burdens that a court must apply in making a decision about the release of a person. Currently and always, the burden of proof is on the prosecution to establish that particular conditions are reasonable and that to assure the defendant's appearance and the safety of the victim and others. How this bill changes that is to create certain offenses or procedural situations, for example, for certain types of offenses or procedural situations. For example, a person has a prior conviction for domestic violence within the past 5 years, and they've come in again, charged with domestic violence, to shift the burden of persuasion, not the burden of proof, to the defendant. And it reads that there is a presumption, a rebuttable presumption, that no condition of release could make the could assure the safety of the victim or the presence appearance of the defendant.
Say that again, please.
Said there, what this does is create a rebuttable presumption that there are no conditions of release or monetary conditions that will either and or assure the appearance of the defendant or the safety of the victim or the community. And what is intended by that is simply that the burden of going forward changes. That is, that the context in which the court begins the inquiry about the conditions of release starts with, you're in this situation, explain to me what you're going to do.
Okay, so Sue, then my question for you is, when we began this legislative session, and we did House Bill 298, the argument that came before the committee from the Attorney General's office was that Alaska was 49th or 50th in being a state that should be not proud of its statistics as it relates to sexual assault and domestic violence. And that was our charge, and this committee has taken that charge very seriously. So the question becomes, if we move to this standard, where does that then place the state of Alaska with regard to bail reform? How strict is the state then becoming? Because this sounds like it's a significant pendulum shift. If we're talking about a bail provisions that haven't been addressed in 44 years, I'm interested in being progressive, but I also want to know at what cost are we pursuing this new standard? So a broad question, what kind of an answer can you provide us?
As I understand your question, Mr. Chairman, it's how do we compare then with the remainder of the 50 states?
Insofar as a new point of view toward bail restrictions, how much I see that we're curbing rights for the benefit of victims and for the benefit of communities, but we're also mindful of, you know, the rights that other citizens have.
Let me start at the beginning, if I may. Everyone has a right to be released on bail in the state of Alaska, except people who are charged with capital offenses. That means everyone, because we don't have capital offenses. What we're doing is saying, if you come before the court charged with certain offenses or having a certain criminal history, it's up to you, the defense, to explain, to begin the dialogue, to say, I will be safe. Here is my proposal for why I won't be dangerous to the victim, why I won't cause harm to the community. And the court can listen to that, and the state can then come forward and say, we are now going to, that's rebuttable, it's preponderance of the evidence, we are now going to show you by other evidence why this person does remain in danger or will be dangerous to the victim or will flee. But the burden of proof never leaves the state.
I was quite clear on that. I grasped that.
Okay.
You're not answering my question, which is, in this, with regard to the standard, where does it move Alaska? Are we now, becoming, where are we relative to the other states insofar as where we're taking the bail reform and taking it to this new standard? Clearly, it sounds like we are moving the standard significantly from where it has been, and so when we peg it out to this new place, where is it relative to the other states?
First of all, let me start by saying this language that I just referred to is the federal law, and it has been challenged and affirmed in every circuit of the United States as being constitutional. You're asking me now, have I done a comprehensive study of each of the states and put us into a statistically into where we fit with them? No, I haven't. I've looked at precisely 25 of them, and I can say there are some with presumptions very similar to this. There are many states where you have a situation similar to this described in our bill where you simply don't get bail. It just is not available to you, period.
What would be some of those states?
Well, let me see if I can find one. Arizona, for example, there is no bail when the proof is evident or the presumption is great for capital offenses. We have that one. Sexual assault, sexual conduct with or sexual molestation of a minor under 15, felony offenses committed when the person is on bail or on a separate felony charge, or any felony offense where the person presents a substantial danger to any other person or the community, and no conditions of release will reasonably assure the safety or the community, the safety of the other person or the community, or serious felony offenses if the person, and this one, the first one, the capital offenses and the sexual offenses, and this one, serious felony offenses if the person has entered or remained in the United States illegally.
Yeah, we're still in Arizona?
I'm in Arizona. So that's an example.
Okay.
So there are many states that take that approach. There are some, like Georgia and Hawaii, that take the presumption approach. And that is that, and we're talking about the burden of going forward here. That's that the that there are the presumption being a rebuttable presumption. This is Georgia, that no conditions will reasonably assure the appearance or safety of other persons if charged with a serious violent felony and was previously convicted of a serious violent felony. That's Georgia, and in Hawaii, there's a rebuttable presumption if the person is charged with an offense that's punishable by life imprisonment without possibility of parole. These are not the no bail offenses. These are similar to what we're discussing. Or a rebuttable presumption that the person poses a danger to the community if they're charged with a serious crime and they've been convicted in the past 10 years of a serious crime, if they're on bail for a felony charge at the time they've committed the new offense, or they're on probation or parole. Okay. Those are examples. I don't have a statistical analysis of where among the 50.
Is always helpful.
Yeah. But that's okay. So.
Sure.
Representative Holmes.
Can I just, sorry, I just wanted to back up for just a second. I had a question. I think it's actually on section 3.
Okay.
I'm on the top of page 5. It's lines 4 through 6. It's subsection H. And I'll just read it really quickly. It's 2 or 3 lines. Information offered or introduced at a bail review hearing before a judicial officer to determine conditions of release need not conform to the rules governing the admissibility of evidence in a court of law. My concern here is, would this mean that in bail hearings, one or the other side could introduce information that might be counter to our rape shield laws or information about medical illnesses or other things?
I wouldn't think so, because I think that those statutes about that govern confidentiality. I mean, we haven't litigated this, but I think the statutes that govern confidentiality, it would certainly be a good objection that those are that this statute doesn't overcome those statutes. What this aims at is that either side, either the defense or the prosecution, can make their proof by a proffer or by hearsay.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll just follow up offline, and we can continue talking about this. Okay. Thank you.
So, just to kind of carry on, as you can see from the bill, the places where we propose to have this preponderance situation is if the defendant is charged with an unclassified Class A or sexual felony, if he or she is charged with a felony, has a previous conviction for a felony, and less than 5 years have elapsed.
Chairman, I just lost track of which page and which line we're on. Sorry.
I'm talking about Section 4. This same presumption would apply if the person was committed while the defendant was on release for another offense, or the charge is a crime involving domestic violence and the defendant was convicted within the past 5 years of a crime involving domestic violence. And again, we're not talking about not releasing people. We're just talking about the idea that the defendant should come forward with a plan for how he will be reliable and safe, he or she.
Before we go, Representative Grunberg has a question.
Thank you. Have you finished answering the question?
I think so.
Oh, okay. I want to go back to page 7, lines 19 through 21. First of all, I think we need to explain to the other folks here who aren't attorneys that the burden of proof involves the twin burdens of going forward and burden of persuasion. So it's both the concept of who has to proceed first and the quantum of proof.
Right.
And when you talk here, through the chair, Ms. McLean, of preponderance of the evidence, that to me, unless you have some specific language to the contrary in the bill, implies the full burden of proof, both the burden of going forward and the burden of persuasion. And when you explained it a minute ago, unless my ears deceived me, but one time you said the burden of persuasion, and then twice later you said the burden of going forward. So I think we need, I think that it implies both the twin burdens. No, you're shaking your head.
I'm sorry, to the chair, I misspoke. All of the federal cases construing the statute and our understanding of the construction of the statute is the defendant has the burden of going, the accused person has the burden of going forward. The state always has the burden of persuasion.
Then this is not written, at least to my knowledge, the way I've ever seen it in the law of this state. The burden where it says by a preponderance of the evidence, that deals with the quantum of evidence.
Correct.
It doesn't deal with the burden of going forward, and it does shift it, and and I need to explain to the other members of the committee. There's the Wigmore and the other thing on rebuttable presumptions. One of them says, and I forget who the other person was, says, if you bring in contrary evidence, you don't flip the burden around. You just, that raises the issue again. But this seems to not only require that that the rebuttable presumption no longer applies, but it flips the burden of persuasion onto the defendant. One theory says if you bring evidence forward to rebut the presumption goes away. The other theory, and this is from my 40-year-ago law.
Representative Grunberg, are you trying to help yourself or the other members of the committee?
Everybody. The question is, this doesn't just make the presumption go away, but it flips the burden that you now have the burden of persuasion, because it says the must be overcome by a presumption, by a preponderance of the evidence. So the defendant has to show it's more likely than not, 51%, that the presumption is not true. It doesn't just have the presumption go away, but it flips the burden around. To the lawyers here, am I right on that?
The presumption for what, though? The presumption?
The presumption that there are no conditions of release that will assure the safety of the victim. So what the defendant has to do is show, more likely than not, here's some conditions of release by which we can assure the safety of the community of the victim. At that point, the burden shifts back, and actually never leaves the state, to prove that the victim, that those conditions won't work. So well, it's a burden of going forward.
As I understand this bill as a layperson, that's precisely the policy call that we're going to make with this whole bill, is who do we want the burden, how do we want the burden to rest? Since 1966, the burden has largely rested on the court system and the prosecution, mm-hmm. and that what we're contemplating with the modernization of this bail provision is to flip it around, and part of, again, I'll remind the committee that when we convened 2 months ago and we heard initial testimony from the Attorney General, what we are trying to address is domestic violence and sexual assault and the fact that I think we were able to prove through the use of words that, in fact, it's not an epidemic that we have, but we have got a serious ongoing issue. We have a rural problem and we have an urban problem. And some of the characteristics are the same. and some of the characteristics are very unique. One of the unique characteristics that we have that I think this committee should be mindful of is that we have people living in remote rural communities who cannot get into a car and drive away to a safe place. And we have people that qualify for bail, even under this standard, that can come back into these communities, and that's that should that is the overarching policy decision that this committee is going to make as we bear into these various sections and determine by degree how much we want to modernize our bail provisions. Is the test for me in a case like this, where we really have a different urban test and a different rural test, is who's most vulnerable. And so for me, as the chair of this committee, the test that I'm going to be providing is going to be the rural test. And I'm going to be looking to satisfy safety for victims and communities as to the rural test, which may in fact be less appropriate for this presumption and for flip-flopping this standard over to the defendant, and may be heavy-handed for an urban application, but in fact quite appropriate for a rural application. And since as the chair of this Judiciary Committee, I don't have a choice or an option of creating a rural standard and an urban standard, but in fact I have to choose a one-size-fits-all standard, then for me as the chair, that's going to be an easy choice to make, for me. And so as we go through this, if that seems an accurate read on the overarching, you know, layperson's interpretation of this bill, then please let me know. And if I'm missing it, then let me know otherwise, and I'll revisit this. And my, let me just ask her first, and then sure, I'll get sure. your opinion. Sure. Do I have it more or less?
There are the crimes that you have spoken of, domestic violence and sexual assault, are identified as crimes where we want to focus the inquiry we're having about the subject of bail and make that a sharper inquiry that causes the court to stop and take notice and think about conducting that dialogue from a different point of view, which is, as you have said, the dialogue here being, you are here again for having assaulted your wife. You're simply accused of it, but you were convicted of it last year. Am I going, why should I release you back to the village where there are 50 people and she can't hide from you?
Right. Village or the city. I mean, it has to be a, this has to be a one-size-fits-all bail provision, even though the application is into two remarkably different communities. Representative Grunberg.
Two things. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Number one, I'm not sure that we can't craft it in a manner that may not simply be rural-urban divide, but we can have conditions that the court could consider in making this determination that deal with the ability to safeguard the victim and still allow the person bail. Let me give you an example. Somebody is on trial in Barrow or Kotzebue for a crime that allegedly occurred in a village, and they're way removed from the village. And I would think that, and Ms. McLean, correct me if I'm wrong, that the court could enter an order prohibiting the person from leaving the trial city or going back to the village as a condition of bail, could she not?
Respectfully, through the chair, as a condition of bail on a limited basis, what the court could enter an order saying you can't have contact with the victim and you can't live 50, you know, can't be within 50 feet of the victim.
The village.
But we all, but when you say you can't travel to a certain location on the face of the earth, the way you've worded it, that you say you have to stay in Barrow, you can't go to the other
or
community.
Or vice versa.
Yeah. Then, you know, the court might do that. But we already have the potential for the court to issue all of those conditions of release. And so this is sort of trying to put a finer point on the focus.
And on one other thing, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Jeannie, 230. But you're welcome to sit with us. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The other thing is looking at subsection B on page 7, lines 25 to 28. These categories A through D are quite different. And for some of the things that you said, Mr. Chair, what you said was very appropriate. But let me give you an example. I represented a defendant named, first name Otto. And Otto was charged with one count of felony, possession of heroin. And the charge was that he had shot heroin into his arm on one occasion. That was it. He was convicted, and, I mean, ultimately convicted. But let's say he was charged 4 years and 9 months later with something similar, taking another shot of heroin or some pill of some kind. I think that we need to look at whether it's appropriate to flip the burden in a case of that type where there's no showing of any danger to anyone else, et cetera, and it's a long time away. I'm just flagging the issue for future discussion.
Well, would that be a little bit like the person that just committed their sixth felony DUI? I mean, if somebody shoots heroin up their arm, what's the assurance that they don't pose a threat to me or to other people that they pull into the use of heroin, or their dealers, or the neighborhoods that they go back into to continue to get more heroin while they're feeding their habit while they're still out on bail. So it takes me back to the safety of the community, and the safety of the victim is the test, more and flips the presumption away from the protection of the person who committed the crime. But I understand their rights, but I also understand the rights of that the community and the community and the victims are entitled to.
I'm not necessarily arguing with you on a case by case basis. I mean, that obviously would be the argument that a prosecutor would make if she was so inclined. What we're talking about here is us sitting as a legislature and determining whether that's an appropriate place in a circumstance like I've said, where the law should be that the burden of proof is appropriately flipped around. I don't want to get into the details. Now, I'm just sort of raising the issue. That's premature.
Sue, your point?
Well, respectfully, through the chair, the situation you described, the possession of a drug, in most cases would not raise to the level of offense. It's not an A felony. It's not an unclassified felony. You'd have to possess it with intent to deliver it. And I think that's the intent here of having a cutoff at which you say a lesser felony doesn't count, but I understand what you're saying. You're talking about a similar felony of any kind.
Mr. Chair, I'm talking sub A. I don't have a problem with particularly.
Sub B.
This is sub B. I'm only talking about sub B. And I'm just flagging the issue, Mr. Chair. I've gone on too long here. I'm talking about sub B, sir.
Mr. Heron. Right.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I appreciate the way you've framed it, but I'll put it, at least from my perspective, is that we got to find balance here because, let's just start with sexual assault, domestic violence. It's an issue of bullies or people that have to be in control of their loved ones or their friends or their neighbors or even their unfriends and the people that they don't like or appreciate. So I guess that what happens in the village, what happens in an urban neighborhood are really the same thing, because people rarely go out of their range, their physical range, whether it's in a village or whether it's in a subdivision or a neighborhood in Anchorage or any large community. So I think that's where that's how I understand it, what you're looking for as well.
Okay. Ms. McLean.
Thank you. May I continue? I think we were still in Section 4, but moving on to the proposed change, the proposed new 1230016, sort of just is the details of what I talked about before, that the court can impose specific conditions of release with specific offenses. We already have that. And for the most part, these are similar or identical to the current law, that, requiring a person to submit to a breath test if they're on release for an alcohol offense, requiring them to requiring that they can't enter a place where people are using drugs if they're on release for a drug offense, and so on. There is a specific new condition in subsection F.
May I interrupt on sub B, please?
Yes, sir.
Question. This is something that has come up once before this committee. I don't believe it's this year, but I know it's in the fairly recent past. Page 8, line 21. Is there a difference? Well, first of all, the term I'm focusing on is reasonable suspicion. Is there, number one, a difference between reasonable suspicion and probable cause? If so, is this use of the term reasonable suspicion a change from the current law, which would be probable cause?
Through the chair, yes, there is a difference. A reasonable suspicion is a lower standard than probable cause. No, there's no difference. This is how the law reads right now.
Would you cite the page?
The current law, if I may just have a moment.
Where are we at?
We're on, you know, he just wanted to know where we're in the bill. We're on page 8, line 21. By a peace officer who has reasonable suspicion. And that's a lower standard than probable cause, but it is the same standard that's now in law, as I understand
that's
what you
correct.
Just said. Thank you.
You know, we just had a case like that in today's Daily Newsminer, the Second Amendment Task Force fellow. They have a Liberty Bell group, and he was just arrested for not disclosing to an officer that he had a weapon on him when they all did a search of a suspected of a home search. Did you read that?
Warrantless
okay.
search.
I did.
Yeah, it wasn't a home search. He was out. Yeah, yeah. I read it this morning.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chair, wasn't that they were gathered by this house where they had suspicion there was marijuana in there, and they conducted, I think it was a warrantless search.
Warrantless search,
and,
right.
And this group apparently was there to make sure the cops did everything okay, and it's the whole thing's strange.
Very elevated. Okay. Thank you.
I would simply add that it allows the court to impose those conditions. It doesn't authorize the police to go doing that without a specific court order as a condition of release. That the person who is released has to submit to these breath tests. It's not that the police are given the authority to make somebody take a breath test. It's that the person is ordered by the court to submit if the police have reasonable suspicion. So I was at section subsection F, I believe, which I would just point out. Adopt specific conditions that the court may impose on a person charged with a sex offense. These, again, are very similar. It would add a condition that the person shouldn't have contact, that the court is permitted to add a release condition that the person have no contact with a person under the 18 years of age. It requires the court, as does current law, to assure that the victim has been notified of any bail hearing, and that is the present law. But it adds that with regards to sex offenses, the court should allow the victim to speak and consider her comments in deciding release and conditions of release. Section 5. Adopt standards for a third-party custodian. I am watching the time, Mr. Chairman. We do have a current statute that authorizes the court to appoint a third-party custodian or require a third-party custodian to watch over a person who's released on bail. this section requires the court to obtain information about the proposed custodian, including the ties to the community and the relationship with the defendant. It sets some minimum standards for the custodian, such as the custodian be physically able to keep the person in their sight or sound, that they not have a pending charge themselves, that they not be on probation for a felony, things of that nature. And there is some dispute about a couple parts of this. From the court system, there was concern because one of the provisions of the qualifications of a third-party custodian is that the third-party custodian not have a misdemeanor offense within the past 5 years or a felony within the past 10, and there was some concern that it won't be possible to find third-party custodians who can meet those qualifications.
Yes, I would have that concern, particularly about misdemeanors. Right. Question for you. We took up a citations bill here in one of our previous meetings, and we're trying to connect the ability for law enforcement to write a citation, and by the time that you go to pay it, to already have the citation in the system. We're trying to connect all those pieces. What about peace officers? How are they going to be aware of these specific bail conditions as we tune up these bail conditions? How are peace officers going to be able to access any unique bail conditions as it relates to people that are out on bail?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the present mechanism in the less sophisticated communities is when the person is released from the jail, the police agency is given, the court system gives the police agency a copy of their conditions of release, and they post it on a clipboard so that all the officers know. My understanding is that the court system, in conjunction with the Department of Public Safety and the Department of Law, is trying to create a computerized system whereby we have real-time conditions of release when the court imposes them. As soon as they're imposed, any police officer can go in his or her computer and find those conditions of release. That doesn't exist across the state yet, but it's in the process of being implemented.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, ma'am.
One question. On page 11, line 7, is physically able to perform the duties.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Carl?
Oh, I was thinking wheelchair bound.
Well, yeah, but my concern is also mentally, too.
Oh, you might want to add that.
Say again?
Through the chair, we might want to add that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm flagging that. Do you see where I'm talking about? Okay.
Right. I do.
So it would be and mentally.
Right. And if I may add, this is just kind of anecdotally from being a practitioner for many years. It never has been necessary for a third-party custodian to stop anyone from violating their conditions of release. Their duty is to report them. Mm-hmm. And so, obviously, we're talking about people that don't have any mechanism by which they can either see or hear whether the person they're supposed to be watching has left or is drinking or is, you know, doing things they're not supposed to be doing. And that's what we're meaning about being physically able. It's not about wrestling the person to the ground if they try to violate it. Can you actually see and hear this person? Can you actually call the police? You know, can you speak or in some way notify the police that this person is violated?
May I ask a question?
Representative Grunberg.
I know, based on what I think it was you said, Mr. Chair, somebody, that there's been a lot of trouble sometimes getting third-party custodians. I think we use third-party custodians more in Alaska than they do in some other jurisdictions. Yeah. And when we get into this, really, Ms. McLean, I would like to have some conversation on the current ability or inability to get custodians and how this bill will affect that, and if there's anything we should do. And I know you folks in the Department of Law have really thought about this, and I'm sure the defense bar is thinking about it also, what the proper balance is, because it does impact people if they have to sit in jail and try to build their defense while they can't really go out and do their investigating and try to get what they need to do, help their lawyer. And it's also expensive. So, you know, I'll be asking questions about this whole thing.
Okay. What offense is a DUI?
What offense
what is first DUI? What
Class A misdemeanor.
It's a Class A misdemeanor?
Yes.
So if somebody had a DUI in the last 5 years, it wouldn't be satisfactory as the custodian?
And respectfully, Mr. Chairman, that's exactly what the court system and I are discussing. Is there a way to,
that's going to be unacceptable for me, because a lot of people who, pretty remarkable, upstanding citizens who have, you know, had a lapse in judgment, but in every other way are upstanding citizens, and to bar all of them from, I think, bars a significant cross-section. So we might want to work on that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grimberg.
We even have some lawyers, and occasionally a judicial officer could be a...
Indeed, yeah. Right, today's paper, right.
Moving along then to Section 6. Section 6 amends the statute addressing general conditions of release of a person charged with a crime involving domestic violence by conforming it to the language used in the newly adopted sections of the bill. It doesn't include any substantive change. Section 7 amends the law that prohibits the court from allowing a person charged with a crime involving domestic violence from returning to the home of the victim. And court in Williams versus State, the legislature had passed a law that said the court may not allow anyone to return to the victim's residence during the entire pendency of the case. In Williams versus State, oversimplifying here, the court said that's overly broad and struck it down as unconstitutional. So what Section 7 does is attempts to limit this to a way that's not overly broad, but still tries to give a period for cooling off, give a period for assessing the level of the dangerousness that, and whether conditions have can be imposed. So how it changes it is that the court would not be allowed to permit a person accused of domestic violence to return home for 20 days, which is the same length of time as is currently provided for in an emergency restraining order, temporary restraining order. After the 20 days have elapsed and the victim consents and the offender can establish, and in this particular case, it's clear and convincing evidence, not that he can't have bail, he could have bail, but that the offender could return to the victim's residence without posing any danger to the victim of the offense. That's what that change is about. I don't know if anybody's really opposed to that.
Mr. Chair,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, as a family lawyer myself, I want to look at this, and the case is Billings, B-I-L-L-I-N-G-S. Do you have a cite? Is that the case you just cited?
Oh, no, the case is Williams.
Williams.
If I may, yes. I mean, basically, Williams versus State is 151 Pacific 3rd, 460, Alaska Appellate, 2006.
151-460?
151-460 P3rd. Yes.
And the date, year?
Alaska Appellate, 2006. And thank it's you. Held that the current statute that says you can't return home, offender can't return home at all, is unconstitutional.
The reason I'm concerned through the chair is it's possible to get a, quote, protective order that's ex parte.
Yeah.
And it might only be a temporary order. And frankly, one thing that family lawyers are concerned about, as a person who's represented both sides in these, that sometimes people use them to bootstrap themselves into custody. And I want to be sure that this law doesn't prohibit a court from adjusting bail conditions or whatever, if necessary, in a case to prevent the misuse of the DV orders. because I have seen cases, and I'm not saying it's the normal thing, but it has happened, where not only does the person get a DV order, maybe on an ex parte basis, but may get a charge, a misdemeanor charge, or some kind of a DV assault charge lodged, and then not only does the other person have to try to deal with the DV itself, but their primary focus is not on the divorce itself, but on the defense on the criminal side. And it can be a very vicious game. And I'm not saying it happens all that often, but it certainly has happened more than once, and I just want to look at this.
Representative Harris?
Yes, Sue, what's the definition in Section 7 of residence?
Where the victim lives.
Okay, going back to the chairman's comment and my comment about whether it's a neighborhood or whether it's a village, can that definition be expanded?
Through the chair, I don't think so, Representative. I mean, but the legislature could consider it. It would be difficult to expand it. Certainly, in addition to any other conditions of release, the court has always had the authority to say you may not have any contact whatsoever with the victim. And more often than not, that is a condition of release. What this does is simply say, we want this period where the victim does not have to allow you to come live in her home with her, or his home with him if the victim is male, and that it's a short period, but that there's some period. But could you expand it? You know, if I may, someone brought something to my attention that I hadn't thought of, and I think this law, if you leave the residence narrowly defined, doesn't create the problem. But one of the people that works with the Department of Health and Social Services brought home, what about people who live in a group home, and mm-hmm. they attack their caretaker in the group home, and we want them to come back to the group home. We just, you know, there was an incident, they need to be arrested, they need to be taken away. And the answer is, it's not the caretaker's residence. So it wouldn't prohibit that. I mean, the caretaker's an employee there, they don't live there. I mean, you could still ask for the condition that the person not come home. But this is a different thing. This is saying the court can't impose a condition that allows the person to return to the victim's residence. I would be willing to consider and talk with my fellow DAs about whether we could expand that.
Representative Herring.
I know you're going to cut it off here pretty quickly, okay. But expanding on the residence issue, and I read with interest Section 7, and it goes back to what the chairman and I said earlier. It's about villages or neighborhoods. So a person could be forbidden to go to the residence, has to stay 50 feet away, but moves back into the home of a family member, which is 100 feet away. Mm-hmm. That's where I have the concern about the residence. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Gatto.
Yep. Thank you. Do you recommend that we just add residence and then add or place of business? I mean, many people will spend a great deal of time in a place of business, and they're open to the public.
Actually, through the chair who's not there, that's abundantly sensible. I mean, usually that's part of the conditions of release, but if you could say the court may not allow the person to go to the victim's place of business at all for 20 days, because, you know, there is a freedom of movement thing going on there. That's probably, I would think that would survive constitutional challenge.
And the question is, it's not really included in the term residence.
It's not included in the term residence.
Residing at your place.
Yeah, you're not residing at your place of business.
All right, are there any further questions? Okay, as the chair has stated, this bill will be heard again in the near future. So we'd like to thank you, and we will be forwarding questions to you. Okay, thanks very much. Why don't we take
a two-minute
at ease here. All right, welcome back to the House Judiciary Committee. We have before us now the CS for House Bill 366, and I would entertain a motion to have the CS before us.
Do we need that?
Oh, it's already.
It's already been adopted? All right, I apologize. Thank you very much. Are there any questions from members of the committee before we go to public testimony online and in the audience?
Madam Chair.
I haven't been introduced yet.
I do realize that, but I just wondered, Representative Gruenberg.
Yeah, as the representative from this committee on the other committee,
correct.
We heard the bill. Jeannie, I don't think there was any controversy at all in the Transportation Committee about this. Subsequently, we got a letter from the Ocean Carrier Equipment Management Association, and we now have an email dealing with a proposed amendment. That's the only thing we've had that's controversial, and I know you want to get this thing taken care of. I think we can do it pretty quickly.
Thank you, Representative Gruenberg. And being aware of that, I did want you to bring that up so that the sponsor could comment on that amendment. And so, without any further questions, we'll proceed. If you'd identify yourself, please.
Thank you for hearing the bill. My name is Jeannie Osnes. I work for Representative Craig Johnson. This bill first came to us through the motor carriers, and it was a situation where a lot of the agreements between the motor carriers and the shippers had what is in the industry called like a cram down provision. The shipper could transfer all of the liability to the carrier and basically indemnify themselves, even if it wasn't caused by the motor carrier. So after the bill was drafted, the shippers enjoyed the bill enough that they wanted to be in it. So we have a section dealing, number two in section one, that deals with the shippers. Both now agree that they will indemnify themselves for their own problems or omissions. And as Representative Gruenberg stated, we heard from the OSEMA, which has agreed to an agreement or an amendment, and the Alaska Trucking Association has agreed to the amendment, and most importantly, my boss has agreed to the amendment. So we're at the point where we can ask any questions, if you'd like, of the bill, and we have two people available online, as far as I know.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
In the House Trans Committee, we adopted my amendment number two, which now appears in the bill. We're talking about on page 2, line 20. It added, the way the amendment in that committee was packing and storage. I see now they have put packing or storage, and I would just ask, since we're going to be taking up an amendment here in a minute, that I'd ask, with the permission of the chair and the members of the committee, if I may dialogue with the bill drafter to see if there's any substantive difference between the "and" as I offered and the word "or" that now appears. And I wanted to point that out. I suspect the answer will be no, but I want this as broad as possible, as we stated on the record. And I'm just putting that on the record, Mr. Chair, unless anybody has a serious objection.
Duly noted.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Gatto?
Oh, I comment on that. I think there's a major difference between packing "or" and packing "and". One
that would be my thought, too. Yeah.
To meet any test.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
At the appropriate time, I think I will make remake the motion to put the word "and" back in, because let me tell you why, to dial for just a second. You could take your goods to a package store, and the package store could do it, and then somebody puts it on, and it goes out in a shipping company, you know, a trucking company. And I don't want the packing company either to be able to skate out from under their own negligence. And that's why we had and. But I, you know, I'll take care of it. I think there is a difference. But I don't know.
Jeannie, do you have more testimony to offer, or may we go to the people online?
Just to let you know, OSEMA did send a letter that you should have in your file indicating the other states that have the same amendment. So, and we can go online now. Thank you.
Thank you. Ave, are you with us? Is Ave with us?
Hello. Yes. Mr. Chairman, this is Ave Thompson.
Hi, Ave. If you'll introduce yourself and your affiliation for the record, provide us your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Ave Thompson. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Trucking Association.
Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I just, I'll keep this brief in the interest of saving some time. Our nearly 200 members represent trucking interests throughout the state. We're fully supportive of this amendment. There have been instances where these indemnification agreements have, we believe, have been abused, and we're very pleased that the shippers and the motor carriers and the ocean carrier equipment management folks can all come together on this and at the end of the day have a very nice piece of legislation that protects the parties, that sets things right, basically, that says that if we're negligent, it's our responsibility. If you're negligent, it's your responsibility. So.
And Aves, can you we appreciate you speaking to the amendment, can you speak to the bill first?
The bill, as Ms. Otna said earlier, the bill prohibits. Let me find it here. Just hang on. I'm calling from my sick bed today, Mr. Chairman.
All right. You've got a lot of empathy here. Yeah.
But
easy on Representative Lynn.
Yeah, the legislation voids contractual provisions in motor carrier contracts that indemnify a shipper or motor carrier for negligent or intentional acts or omissions of the other party, which leads to claims. And that's the basic premise of the bill, that it's trying to assign liability where it belongs. If a motor carrier is negligent, the motor carrier is responsible for their negligent acts. If a shipper is negligent, the shipper is responsible for their negligent acts.
Thank you, Abe. So we appreciate that. And then you support the amendment also. Is that correct?
Yes, we do.
Thank you. Are there questions for Abe? Okay. Thank you very much, Abe. We appreciate you weighing in today. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Can we go next to Dean McKenzie, please?
Mr. Chair, this is Dean McKenzie. I'm the president of Alaska West Express, which is one of the Linden operating companies. We employ about 120 people in Alaska between Fairbanks and Anchorage, another 24 in Tacoma. I'm a past president of the Alaska Trucking Association and currently serve as a legislative chair. We feel strongly that House Bill 366 is a very good bill, and we would encourage the support and passing of the bill and the amendment. As an example, we're currently working to negotiate a master service agreement with a major international drilling company that is doing the very thing we're talking about here, and that's trying to transfer all liability to the carrier, even if it's caused by their own employees or their material itself. And it's just not right. You know, we've been pretty successful over the last several years with the major oil companies and big box shippers to get these provisions changed so there are in insurance parlance, a knock-for-knock type situation where each party is responsible for their own actions. We're able to do it because we've got a fair amount of clout, but there's a lot of small carriers out there that don't have that same resource, and we see them getting into trouble by just signing off, because in a lot of cases it's either do it and get the money rolling in or they're out of business the next day. So it's the right thing to do. We would encourage the committee to vote yes on the bill and the amendment and move it out of committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Dean. Are there questions for Mr. McKenzie? I don't see any from the committee. We appreciate your input and your testimony today. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
Jeannie, do you have any other remarks?
No.
Are there questions for the bill sponsor, Representative Gruber?
Just one thing. There's a, should be a little one paragraph in here involving a Texas anti-indemnification statute case. And I don't have the case itself, but this is a synopsis that a trial court had granted summary judgment in favor of the trucking company dismissing indemnity claims by an equipment provider based on the provisions of the Uniform Act. And the trial court found that requiring a motor carrier to indemnify other parties against their own negligence was unenforceable as against the public policy of Texas. And Ms. Austin says, I understand it. If we pass the amendment to this bill, then that would provide specifically in state law that such indemnification agreements that are uniform, like this specific one, would not be contrary to public policy. And so it would prevent a result like the Texas trial court handed down, right?
As far as I can tell. That was CMA CGM America versus Empire Truck Lines. And
do you have a cite on that?
You should have.
Oh, I've got it. Oh. Oh, this is the case.
Do you want us to call brief at ease for you, Representative Gruber?
No, I just didn't see the name of the case here. Oh, yeah. Okay, we've got the case. 285 Southwest 3rd at 9. It's a March 2009 case. And it would reverse the result in this case, which is what we want to do. Thank you very much.
Jeannie, well done. Are there any questions for the bill sponsor? Is there anybody in the room or online that wishes to testify? See none. Public testimony is closed on House Bill 366. We'll bring it back to the committee. Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The members should have in their packet a copy of an amendment that's labeled E2, and I would ask that be labeled Amendment 1.
We have Amendment 1 before us. Is there an objection? Seeing none, Amendment number 1 is adopted. Representative Gruenberg, do you want to have a discussion about the word and or?
No, I would just, since we've already adopted it in the Transportation Committee, I will use that as the basis if there's any question about and or. And I don't have to bring it up again before this committee. I just put it on the record.
Are there any other amendments for House Bill 366? Seeing none, the chair would entertain a motion. Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wish to move the CS for House Bill number 366, 26-LS1434/E, with amendments attached, physical note, and individual committee recommendations.
Thank you. Seeing no objection, HB 366 moves from committee. It's 10 minutes of 3. We're adjourned for the day.